Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Stephen Dozeman, here today with Richard Polt to discuss his recent book, Time and Trauma, Thinking Through Heidegger in the 30s. For some time, the German philosopher Martin Heidegger has been treated with a certain level of skepticism because of his engagement with the Nazi Party, a skepticism that has resurfaced with the publication of the Black Notebooks, private journals he kept throughout the last several decades of his life. Diving right into the core of Heidegger's philosophy, Polt starts by taking a close look at Being and Time, published in 1927, followed by a close analysis of his philosophical developments in the 1930s. He shows through a close textual analysis that Heidegger's political engagement stemmed from certain philosophical commitments. The book then ends with an attempt to see what, if anything, can be salvaged from Heidegger's philosophy for political thinking. Richard Polt is a professor of philosophy at Xavier University, and is the author of, among other things, Heidegger, An Introduction, and The Emergency of Being on Heidegger's Contributions to Philosophy. He is co-editor with Gregory Fried of the book series New Heidegger Research, and together they have translated a number of Heidegger lectures, including Introduction to Metaphysics, Nature, History, State, and Being and Truth. So, Richard Polt, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you very much.
So before we dive in, we like to ask our guests to kind of introduce themselves to listeners. So could you tell us a bit about yourself and what your main interests are?
Yes. Well, as you said, I've published a number of things about Heidegger, and I've also collaborated with Gregory Fried on translating some texts of Heidegger's, especially rather political texts from the 1930s. And together we also edit a book series called the New Heidegger Research series, in which my book Time and Trauma is published. As a teacher, I get into a lot of other topics. I teach a lot of Plato and Descartes and other ancient philosophy. And more recently, in my writing and research, I've gotten into questions of philosophy of technology and environmental philosophy that have sort of branched out from Heidegger.
All right, great. So before diving into your book in detail, we'll be looking at Heidegger's development roughly from the publication of Being and Time in 1927 to the end of World War II in 1945. So at the beginning of this period, Heidegger was kind of a rising philosophical star, having just published this really groundbreaking new book. And by the end, he is banned from teaching and has a severe mental breakdown, for which an extensive recovery was needed. So can you give us a brief summary of this time period for Heidegger, just to help contextualize things for us?
Sure. So as you say, it's a pretty dramatic, almost tragic collapse, but it's also a very creative period. And it's a period, you said a lot of people are skeptical about Heidegger's politics. That's a very polite way of putting it. He joined the Nazi Party in 1933 and was the first National Socialist rector of the University of Freiburg. He stepped down after a year, but of course, people ever since then have had a lot of doubts about him, at least so. Intellectually, philosophically, there's a lot going on. He's doing things like reading the pre-Socratics and Nietzsche and Ernst Jünger. He's teaching on all sorts of topics. He's also writing a whole series of private texts. He's incredibly productive, and it's a period of ferment. It's a period where he's very experimental. So Personally, I find Being in Time to be really quite persuasive as a description of the human condition. After about 1930, he gets into things that are much more questionable, but very creative and interesting. So to make sense of all this and to sort of find a focus, I focused in my own book on three themes that develop from Being in Time. One is selfhood, or the question of who one is and who we are. Another is the idea of an emergency or crisis. And then finally, the idea of what he calls an inception. And this was something that you didn't get in Being in Time, but where does the human condition come from, or Dasein, as he calls it? Where does human temporality come from? So I try to trace those three themes, selfhood, emergency, and inception, through the 30s and see how they play out in his political thought in particular.
Yeah, so early in the book, you unpack some of the key themes of Being in Time to see how they'll be developed in the next decade. One of the most important things you unpack early in the book is Heidegger's ecstatic temporality and how it allows us to stand out and enter authentic temporality. Can you unpack this a bit for us?
Yes. So some traditional cultures might picture time as a cycle, a circle. We tend to think of it as a line when we represent time. But for Heidegger, these are inadequate, and really we should think of it ecstatically, in the sense that we stand out temporally. We stand out into the future, the past, and the present. What this means is that in the future ecstasis, as he calls it, we're faced with the question of who we are, or the sense of our being, what we're living for the sake of. In the past, we are faced with the fact that we've already been somebody. We're already finding ourselves in a situation we're thrown into. And then as the future and the past intersect, the present is opened up as a meaningful sphere where we can act, we can operate, so we can encounter things. So there are these three dimensions of time. And Heideggerian time is meaningful, it's dramatic, and it has unique contents at every moment. So it's quite different from this sort of homogenous timeline. And the idea of ecstasis emphasizes that we're not ever simply limited to some spatiotemporal point, but we're always beyond ourselves. He says that the human being is not a thing that stops at its skin. We extend out into the world and into history. Now, about authenticity, normally we're not authentic. That is, we're not normally really grappling with this human condition, but we're sort of sunk into the present and we're busy dealing with the things that confront us in the present world. But he thinks that at certain extraordinary moments, moments of crisis, we can come to grips with who we are, face our own mortality, face our own guilt or responsibility, and have, at least temporarily, a clear-sighted, resolute attitude towards our own existence. And there are even some suggestions in Being in Time and more later that, in a sense, this ecstatic temporality is generated by these authentic moments. If we didn't have these moments of crisis and vision, then time would not stretch out, or at least not as intensely as it does for us.
After the publication of Being in Time, Heidegger would develop his thinking on time and temporality and start referring to the event. What prompted this turn for him, and what was the significance of the event for his developing thought?
Well, that's a huge question about Heidegger's post Being in Time thinking. The word in German is Ereignis, das Ereignis, which normally means the event. But everything is controversial about this, including whether it should be translated as event or not. It echoes the word eigen or own. So it has been translated as enowning, which of course is not an English word, or appropriation, or the event of appropriation. For me, it's helpful to look at the main text where he develops it, which is the Contributions to Philosophy, which is one of these private texts that he started writing in 1936. And there he says that Das Ereignis is short for Das Ereignis der Dagründung, or the event of the grounding of the there. That to me is very helpful. So Heidegger's word for human or humanoid beings is Dasein, being there. So we always have a there, we have a context or a world. And in Being in Time, he was just interested in describing worldhood, describing what it's like to be in a world. But then he starts thinking about how the there is grounded or founded. How does it begin? So I interpret Ereignis as, in fact, an event. It's an extraordinary, unique sort of event in which a world opens up. And Dasein's ecstatic temporality is torn open, as he puts it in some texts. It's a radical moment in which meaning opens up, and the question of who we are becomes an urgent question. And this obviously can have some political implications if you think of the grounding of the there as a founding of a community.
One of the last things you turn to in the first chapter is boredom, or the emergency of a lack of emergency. This was part of his turn from strictly philosophical problems and part of his turn towards more explicitly historical and political questions. So what exactly was his concern regarding boredom?
This comes up in a really interesting lecture course from 1929-1930 called The Fundamental Concepts of Metaphysics, where he talks, among other things, about animals, the being of animals. And he has a very long and, in fact, almost boring phenomenology of boredom, where he talks about experiences like standing around a train platform waiting for a train. But that's superficial boredom. And he claims that in his culture at the time, in his world, there is a deeper boredom. There's a sort of deep ennui. What it means is that people don't feel the crisis that I was talking about earlier. They're sort of closed off to a crisis. Nothing feels urgent. Nothing feels unique. One way of thinking about this is that a really intense and vivid and meaningful moment is something you experience as happening for the first and last time. It will never recur. But in everydayness, as Heidegger calls it, nothing happens for the first and last time. Everything is a repetition of some sort of routine, which can get oppressively dull. He says in these lectures that you need what he calls inner terror for greatness. So he really wants to shake things up. He doesn't want us to be either too comfortable or too bored. He wants us to feel emergency or urgency. And that's what he gets in the 30s. He leaps into a political revolution and what he thinks is a philosophical revolution in an attempt to really get us to feel that there is a crisis.
Both in the end of the first chapter and throughout the second, Heidegger starts translating some of his key questions around selfhood into collective and political questions, and starts developing ideas around authentic historicity. You develop this around two key concepts he develops, founding and the Volk. So what exactly was he wrestling with philosophically at this time?
Well, a lot of things, but these themes you mentioned grow out of a point in Being in Time that Dasein is always being with others. So even if you're a hermit or you're solitary or you're lonely, those are just modes of being part of a society or culture or community. And Being in Time touches on what seems like more political questions in a crucial section where he refers to a people. He uses the word folk for once in the book. And he says that a generation can discover its collective destiny through communication and struggle. And then in the 30s, he really tries to transition from that general philosophical point to actually being part of his community, the Germans and the Westerners also more broadly, and asking, who are we? The question that he keeps repeating, who are we, is not supposed to discover a sort of preset identity, but it's supposed to generate the self as a problem, I would say. Selfhood as a question. He says, we are insofar as we seek ourselves. So unless you're really asking, you're actively asking the question of who you are and who we are in your community, in a sense, you do not fully exist. You're not, at least you don't authentically exist. And this connects to what I was saying about inception and the grounding of the there, a shared world or a shared there for a community requires this question of selfhood. He thinks that there are a few figures who might be particularly influential in founding this shared there. Typically, it would be the poet, the thinker, and the statesman. The poet for Heidegger in the 30s becomes Friedrich Hölderlin. The thinker is, of course, Heidegger, and the statesman is you-know-who.
Right. So one of the key themes, one of the other key themes Heidegger works through is that of struggle, which he felt was being trivialized by the Nazis, turned from a way of keeping oneself open for questioning, as you put it, and instead downgraded into an identity in and of itself. Can you kind of unpack this concept a bit and the relationship it had to his ongoing thoughts on the politics of his day?
Sure. And I was just touching on some of this. I think for Heidegger, the question, who are we, is supposed to be sustained. As he says in one text, it should be sustained throughout our entire short lifetime. So as soon as you settle down into an answer, you're being inauthentic. You're settling into an identity, which is a word he doesn't use and which I don't really care for, because when we talk about our identity, it sounds like it's something that we can identify and that's identical throughout throughout the changes that occur. So it seems to point to some sort of underlying thing or essence that belongs to us. And that's not how Heidegger thinks about human existence. So there has to be a struggle to keep asking the question, and there can be the projects or articulations of a shared destiny, but they're not supposed to settle into an identity. Now, this overlapped somewhat with Nazi language and with what Heidegger at least thought was going on at the time of the revolution. So, of course, Hitler's book is called Mein Kampf, My Struggle. And there was a lot of talk at the time and throughout the Nazi regime of struggle. But I think Heidegger's idea is actually more open-ended and more subtle than the typical Nazi point of view. So we could compare it, for instance, to Carl Schmitt in The Concept of the Political, which was published a little bit before Hitler's rise to power, but then Schmitt became a pretty enthusiastic supporter of the regime. According to Schmitt, the political per se is defined by us versus them. It's defined by who your enemy is. And he uses a lot of ontological or existential language. So the enemy is whoever is a threat to the being of the community. Mostly, Schmitt seems to mean what we mean today in this common phrase, existential threat. In other words, a threat to our continued existence or survival. But Heidegger would say there's a deeper question. There's not just survival, but who you are, how you interpret your collective selfhood, which is a more subtle thing, and ultimately more important, he would say, than whether you simply continue to live. So a real existential threat would be one that shatters the complacency of a community about who we are, makes them rethink it, makes them re-ask the question, who are we? This is the kind of struggle that he wanted. And by the way, I'll recommend a book by my friend and collaborator, Gregory Fried, Heidegger's Polemos, which brings out Heidegger's emphasis on struggle and confrontation by way of his readings of Heraclitus on Polemos or war.
Yeah, so at this point, you finally turn to the Black Notebooks. And Before we dive into their specific content, could you maybe contextualize the notebooks a bit and explain what exactly they are and why they've generated so much attention and like what sort of genre they are and how we ought to engage with them?
Sure. The black notebooks are literally a set of notebooks that were bound in black, and they're in the process of being published. Heidegger has been very, very prolific from beyond the grave. His collected works are about 100 volumes, and they're still not all published. They keep coming out. These black notebooks are basically journals, thought journals, and they are the main reason for the latest wave of concern and alarm about Heidegger's politics. Because they include a lot of frank comments about the politics of the day and current events. And most notoriously, they include comments about Jews or so-called world Judaism. So many people assumed and had some evidence that Heidegger was somewhat anti-Semitic, as you would have to be really to be a member of the Nazi party. But there wasn't much in the texts that really supported that. But in these black notebooks, starting in the late 30s, there are various disturbing comments. Let's see if I can find a couple of them. He says that world Judaism is responsible for the uprooting of all beings. Here's the whole quote. "The question of the role of world Judaism is not a racial question, but a metaphysical one, a question that concerns the kind of humanity which in an utterly unrestrained way can undertake as a world historical task the uprooting of all beings from being." So what's troubling about this is that he's joining his language of being and beings to these anti-Semitic tropes of the rootless Jew who is not only rootless, but uproots local traditions and is a threat to rootedness. So this is a disturbing sort of comment. Now, Heidegger's strongest enemies have said, aha, so this is what Heidegger's really all about. He directed that his executors should wait until the last phase of the publication of his collected works to publish the black notebooks. And so, according to his enemies, this is the capstone of the entire project. And now we find out what the real message of all this talk about being really is. It's an endorsement of the Holocaust. That's a point of view that we have to take seriously and think about. I do think it's overblown, though. I think the comments on Jews are sort of random and scattered and not very well developed. And we also have to notice that there are a lot of comments about Nazis, which are, in fact, much more frequent and quite critical. So it's a complicated point, and I'll return to this a little bit later. I think we also have to keep in mind, as you said, the genre of these black notebooks. What are they? So I call them thought journals, and anybody who's kept a sort of philosophical journal, I think, understands that it's not a system. It's not the final word about things. You're trying out different ideas or exploring different moods, and you're not sure where they're going to go, and you're not necessarily committed to these ideas that develop there as part of your philosophy. You're trying to work things out on paper, which is something Heidegger was always trying to do. He was a constant scribbler. So I don't think we should overestimate their importance, but nevertheless, it's something we need to look at very carefully.
Yeah, so you alluded to this just now, but you described the black notebooks as being a place for him to go vent certain frustrations. And the result is that the notebooks have this really kind of bitter taste to them. Interestingly, many of his frustrations were with Nazism itself, but he places it next to liberal democracy and Soviet communism, which he thought were all embodiments of the same underlying logic. What was the driving force behind all these political paradigms as he saw it, and why was he so frustrated with them?
Yes. Well, a kind of bitterness certainly is the overriding mood of these texts. And they were dark times, of course, but it does get somewhat monotonously grim. Everything he describes gets interpreted as part of modern thoughtlessness and nihilism and decay. And in my view, he paints with too broad a brush. So everything, all alternatives, start to look the same. This is, of course, after the period of his enthusiasm for Nazism, which he dates to the period 1930 to 1934. So as early as 1930, we now know that he was enthusiastically recommending Mein Kampf to his brother. In 1934 is when he steps down as rector. I do think that you can see after that that he becomes somewhat increasingly skeptical about Nazi ideology and disillusioned to a certain extent. So the point of view that I'll describe is from the later 30s and the 1940s. He starts to see fascism, Nazism, communism, and liberal democracy as all essentially the same. They're all expressions of what he calls subjectivity in his sense. Earlier, I was referring to the concept of an underlying identity for human beings as sort of assuming that there's this thing that stays the same, that's identical. This could also be called subjectivity in the sense that there's a subject, something that is lying underneath our actions and thoughts, a sort of substratum that is, as it were, solid and enduring and self-certain. And which then tries to establish certainty and control over the rest of the world through a sort of will to power. So this is a modern view, a modern understanding of what it means to be human and to relate to objects. Heidegger thinks that liberalism, liberal democracy, is a sort of subjectivism in a pretty obvious way where individual citizens are sort of atomistic subjects who are deciding what they think and what they want and acting accordingly. And that's how they represent themselves, and trying to control or consume the world from their individual points of view. For the communists, there's a sort of collective subjectivity, class subjectivity, but also trying to technically control and dominate the world. And then he comes to see Nazism as actually, the ultimate form of subjectivity, where through an extreme totalitarian regime, the folk, the people, or the race is the unit of subjectivity, again, trying to control the world. So he doesn't see any essential difference among these political systems. Another way he approaches it is in terms of certain characteristics of late modernity that he thinks are sweeping across the globe. The main one is what he calls machination, a controlling, domineering approach to things as resources, if you will. He associates this with what he calls brutality, in a special sense that where we think of ourselves as animals or brutes who also have logic or reason. And who can use logic and calculation to satisfy our animal desires. He also uses the concept of criminality in a special sense, where it means breaking up the established order in order to then stick it back together again through coercion or force. So all these factors, subjectivity, machination, criminality, brutality, are at work in National Socialism, but also in other modern movements as he sees them. And he's looking for something else. He thinks all of these are late modern manifestations of what he calls the first inception, going all the way back to early Greek thought, which was a very promising, exciting, rich beginning, which is eventually hardened into this domineering will to power. And he is looking for what he calls a second inception or the other inception, which might be some sort of mysterious new dawn that could come about at some indefinite point in the future.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You write about Heidegger's desire to find the, quote, inner truth of the Nazi movement, and how this at times put him at odds with Nazi orthodoxy, since he didn't buy into the more crude biological racism. While this interest in abstract truths does exempt him from certain accusations of biological racism, it also leads him to make some equally disturbing remarks regarding war, annihilation, and the Jews that aren't what we might expect from an enthusiastic Nazi, but instead demonstrate a more detached callousness towards certain historical events. Can you kind of unpack his approach here, how it differed from more orthodox Nazism, and how at the same time, it doesn't just exempt him, it leads him to a sort of detached and disengaged callousness towards the events of his time?
Sure. And I think this is something we can see pretty clearly in the Black Notebooks. It is important to see that he was against biological racism, as you put it. He will occasionally use the word race during the 30s, but he is always very allergic to the idea of judging people in terms of genetics or descent in a biological sense, mostly because Heidegger sees this as profoundly historical, and biology is a non-historical factor. Of course, this doesn't stop him from supporting, to a certain extent, a racist regime and collaborating with it. I do see him developing this detachment, this disengagement you were talking about, as the 30s go on. And that has its own problems. It's not the sort of the standard racism we associate with somebody who's a member of the Nazi Party, but there's a kind of lack of empathy and lack of sensitivity to concrete human beings and situations. I've already discussed this in terms of the way he lumps all these political movements together. They're all forms of subjectivity. You know, maybe at a certain level that's true in terms of the way their ideologies have been articulated. Yet, you know, practically on the ground, it makes a huge difference whether you're living under Hitler or under FDR, let's say. There's a disdain in Heidegger going back to being in time for historical research, historical facts. And in German, conveniently, there are two different words that can be translated as history. There's Historie, which is what historians do. And there's Geschichte, the Germanic word, which is more the underlying happening that makes it possible but not necessary for people to become historians. And Heidegger's always trying to get at the deeper Geschichte, this happening which involves a kind of ecstatic history. There's a collective heritage, a collective destiny, at least as a question, a collective present world, and these are all interacting. And he's trying to think on that level, on that scope, on that scale. There are some passages where he refers to historical facts. This is in the Black Notebooks, as the frayed threads of the fluttering semblance of concealed history, or the most superficial gray scum of a concealed history. So it's utter contempt for particular facts, and I would say that implies contempt or disdain or a lack of empathy for particular people and their concern and sufferings. What goes along with this, and what's most callous and most disturbing, is that even though he has this ideological or metaphysical critique of Nazism as a kind of subjectivism, there's a very important passage from about 1938 where he says, I no longer think that this movement is a new inception. I understand basically that it's just a form of late modernity, but for this very reason, it must be affirmed. Now, why does he say this? I think the answer is that he thinks National Socialism is the most extreme form of modern machination and nihilism, and only if you have something that extreme is the whole thing going to come to some sort of salutary collapse or catastrophe, and only then, once the rubble has come down and once the dust has cleared, only then can there be a new inception. So he affirms the coming catastrophe as he sees it. This is, of course, it requires a sort of deep, cold indifference to what's going to happen to particular people in this process, whereas he says, everything will be pulverized and the earth will explode, but this could be no misfortune at all. It will just make it possible to have a new dispensation of being.
So after working through his thinking in the 1930s, you start trying to critically engage with Heidegger's politics and see what, if anything, can be salvaged. One area you find some ambivalence about is Heidegger's critique of the Enlightenment subject, since he has this very productive critique of the isolated, rational person. But you find his response, while gesturing in a more inner social direction, has limits. You write, quote, "Despite Heidegger's communal impulse, the moment of vision is an essentially secret and incommunicable decision on which authentic relations with others are subsequently grounded." Can you unpack this critique of his a bit, and maybe what we can salvage from it versus what we ought to discard?
Yes, this is a huge question. Heidegger is an anti-Enlightenment thinker. And the Enlightenment is capable of excesses and of forgetting the dark, if you will. The way he puts it in essays such as The Origin of the Work of Art is that there's world and there's earth. World is a sort of illumination that goes along with being part of a culture. But earth is the obscure ground of all that to which we're indebted and which we can never fully reveal. And you could say that the Enlightenment forgets the earth. It forgets our embodiment, our thrownness, to use a Heideggerian word, our indebtedness, the fact of that there are mysteries that cannot be eliminated. There are abysses that cannot be proven or understood and explained. Now, this, I think he has some important points to make there, and Heideggerian thinking can be a sort of bulwark against the overconfidence of the Enlightenment and a sort of a reductive attempt to explain everything in terms of our rational concept. But there are obviously dangers that go along with this. So the danger of Heideggerian thinking is that you're looking for these mysterious abyssal events that come out of nowhere that we can understand and that transform the world. And when an event like that happens, he doesn't seem to have any room for some sort of abiding norms or institutions or guidelines that might help us deal with it, because these events are going to transform our entire world, reground the world. And so all existing institutions and norms and concepts just don't apply. I think events like that can happen, revolutionary events, but we have to be very, very cautious about them. Now, as far as the secret and incommunicable decision goes, this has to do with the theme of language and silence that Heidegger explores in a lot of texts of the 30s and that I discuss in my book. He claims that language arises from silence. We could put it in terms of the Enlightenment illumination arises from the abyss and the mystery and darkness. If that's the case, then you can't really ground a new regime or a new political order on some sort of articulated, rational discourse or principles. It has to be this mysterious origin. And he claims that each of us, each individual in this situation, this revolutionary situation, needs to buy in, as it were, make a secret, a personal individual choice to support the new regime. And then there can be unanimity put together out of all these secret, silent decisions. Now, what's missing there is some sort of public sphere where these decisions could be worked out through discourse, through discussion, through reasoning in a broad sense. I don't think it all has to be based on logic and absolute principles, but there should be some sort of shared discourse if we're really going to have a political sphere. So what can be salvaged from his critique of the Enlightenment? I think he raises appropriate doubts or reminds us to not be overconfident in what reason can achieve. But I do think we need to make a place for discourse, for conversation, for debate within politics. And we need to respect that as more than just what he would consider idle talk or chatter or superficial blathering.
Another area you find Heidegger simultaneously interesting and helpful, but in a somewhat limited way, is in his attempt to define the we, how a we emerges and is defined. What are the stumbling blocks Heidegger runs into with this theme, and what can be salvaged for a more social vision of political engagement?
Well, I think the who are we is a great question. It is one that's always at least implicit for any community and for any member of a community. It's not always squarely faced. For example, if we say, let's make America great again, the question is implicit there, right? What is greatness? What is American? What are we all about? Or to pick on somebody from the other side, President Obama used to say, that's not who we are, trying to stand up for a certain ideal of America. But well, that's a question. Who are we? So I think it's an excellent question, but there are certain implications there that Heidegger only touches upon briefly or ignores. For instance, when we say, who are we? Well, who's invited to ask that question? Are immigrants invited? Are minorities invited? Who gets to count as the we group to begin with? There are always minorities. There are always different we's. Every individual belongs to not just one collective, but a group of collectives. So this is what we call intersectionality these days. I'm always part of more than one we. How do those different we's or who's get sorted out? Often they conflict with each other. The we also spills out beyond the boundaries of a state or a territory. It spreads out culturally. People go out to other communities. They mingle with other communities. And then these different communities, nations, different collective who's have to interact with each other somehow. And possibly they can ask, who are we human beings? All of this is essential to politics, but it's something that Heidegger doesn't work out in any satisfying detail. I like the idea that the question, who are we, must remain open. And I think every community will pursue that question along certain lines where it takes the form of several concrete questions. For instance, there's a book called The 13 American Arguments. The idea is that America is not defined by a set of principles. It's defined by a set of often strenuous or even violent disagreements. So it's those questions, though, that make us Americans, and other communities will have other enduring questions. So in short, I like Heidegger's emphasis on the question, who are we, but it needs to be developed and nuanced much more than he does.
Towards the end of the book, you try to salvage a Heideggerian political philosophy by supplementing it with Hannah Arendt's outline of the political sphere, which is a bit more sophisticated and helpful. In particular, you look at her distinctions between political work and political action. So can you unpack this distinction and how it leads to a vision of political engagement that has certain similarities and parallels with Heidegger, but also some very fundamental and maybe productive differences?
Sure. Arendt, as listeners may know, was a student of Heidegger's and for a while was a lover of his, and learned from him as well as from Aristotle. She, in The Human Condition, she distinguishes helpfully, I think, between labor, work, and action. So in her terms, labor is the sort of routine, everyday things we need to do to sort of keep ourselves going. Work is a more constructive erection of something that's going to last, that's going to provide the framework for a shared world, a sort of forum for us. And then action is the most subtle of these concepts. It's what we do within that constructed world. Action for her typically takes the form of speaking. Speaking is the primary form of action. It's always interpersonal. It's plural. There are many unique individuals coming together in a public space, and we act by debating with each other, speaking to each other. This is also how we not only reveal each other, but become who we are. We become who we are through exposing ourselves to these interactions. These interactions are all beginning new events, new unpredictable chains of events. So she's very interested in initiative, or what she calls natality, the fact that we can give birth to new happenings. I think she's also very helpful in describing what she calls the disabilities of action. In other words, there are a lot of limitations to what you can do in the public sphere. You don't know how your enterprise is going to turn out. It's going to depend on how others receive it and what they do with it. And you don't even know what it means necessarily. You may look back and decide, oh, I didn't even know what I was doing. And often you won't succeed. And so this public sphere of action is one that's full of irony. It's full of reversals. It's full of frustrations. But that's how we become who we are. And there's a connection to Heidegger, the question of who, the question of selfhood, individual and collective selfhood. And the idea of inception, too, which for Heidegger is something very mysterious and mystical, a sort of this creation of a shared there or world. And sometimes it's not even clear that it's ever really happened to his satisfaction. And for Arendt, she makes this something that can happen repeatedly and frequently if there is a place for it, if there's a public sphere. So I find that her ideas are helpful for making some of these Heideggerian concepts, inception, selfhood, crisis, making them a little more relevant to politics as we experience it.
One of the limits you find in Heidegger is his continued interest with the politician as a poet or a maker. Even as he grew dissatisfied with Hitler in particular, his vision of politics still stems from his ideas regarding art, poetry, creation, and illumination. And an individual who's able to do all these things in such a way as to lead us. Can you unpack Heidegger's vision of political leadership and change, and how it ultimately ends up subverting his vision of a more social vision of political agency and engagement?
Yes, I think here's where we can identify some clear problems in Heidegger's political thought with some help from Hannah Arendt. Let's start with a seminar that he gave in 1933-34. Gregory Fried and I have translated it under the title Nature, History, State. And these are actually student notes, but they seem to be a pretty reliable reflection of what Heidegger said. And this was when he was rector of the University of Freiburg. So this is his most political phase and his most Hitlerian phase. And what he says there about the Führer, the leader, is quite alarming. He says that some people are just leaders by birth, a leader in accordance with their personal destiny. And they don't need to be educated. They don't need philosophical training, but there could be a band of guardians, as he says, a sort of philosophical, perhaps military squad that assists the leader. And the leader's soaring will show the people its path forward. And he even said that the whole purpose of education will be to align the people with the will of the leader and to establish unanimity. So this is really a dictatorship and totalitarian vision. After he steps down, he does, as I've said, become a little more skeptical and remote and ultimately quite critical of Nazi ideology. But he doesn't develop an alternative view of leadership. I think he continues to think of leadership as a kind of work in Arendt's sense. So I was saying that work is the construction of a space. Architecture would be the typical work, whereas action, in Arendt's terms, is what is supposed to happen in that space. And it's not unanimity. It's not obedience and alignment with the leader's will. It's becoming ourselves through free discourse and debate. Heidegger, like many other theorists and philosophers, sees politics, though, as a matter of work or making, which is essentially not intersubjective. You know, somebody can be a craftsman who's making a product and can be isolated in a workshop and can have a plan that he follows out in his work. And if he's an expert, everything can be subjected to that plan pretty reliably. So there aren't the disabilities of action. People who don't respect action and its intersubjective disabilities and just see that as a mess and an obstacle to getting things done, they will tend to think of politics in terms of work as a sort of architectonic process. And Heidegger, I think, continues to do that. So even as after he becomes disillusioned with politics, where does he look? He looks to a poet, a poietes, a maker, literally in Greek, as a sort of founder who has this vision that inspires the people. That doesn't leave room for action in the Arendtian sense, which is what I think is a much more promising way of thinking about politics.
In the final chapter of the book, you develop what you call a traumatic ontology, which involves thinking of the subject in terms of certain phenomenological themes, particularly excess and anxiety. So to wrap things up, what is traumatic ontology and how does it help us think of ourselves as political agents?
Well, this is the most speculative and maybe most original part of my book, and it's an experiment in trying to develop a way of thinking that takes what I consider to be the best of Heidegger. So after all these criticisms of his thought, I do think that these three main themes from the 30s are important, and they are, again, selfhood, emergency, and inception. The way he applied those, especially politically, was very problematic. But I think these are real elements of the human experience. So what I do is I take the concept of emergency, and I call it trauma, and I try to apply it to a range of experiences that goes beyond what we usually think of trauma as, which is a very dramatic negative experience, right? A terrible wound that is difficult to heal. I take it more broadly so that it includes also lesser small shocks, reversals, surprises, and also they can be positive. You know, think of falling in love and Cupid shoots you in the heart with an arrow. That's a sort of trauma, but not necessarily an unpleasant one. And this is not only a question of psychology, but a question of our relationship to being. In other words, how we make sense of things, how we encounter things. I'm trying to develop what I call a traumatic empiricism. It's an empiricism in the sense that all knowledge and understanding comes from experience. But experience isn't just sense experience. It's this range of traumas in that broad sense, little reversals, shocks, surprises, encounters with what doesn't fit our preconceived notions. And it's through all these little and big wounds and through how we incorporate them or heal them or get past them or live with them, that's how our understanding of being develops. I think this very general approach applies in a lot of areas. It applies in love, in religion, also in politics, because in politics, I think we need to be open to surprises, reversals, ironies, reinterpretations, ironic outcomes of the sort I was describing when I was talking about Arendt. And so the politics is always going to be traumatic in that broad sense. So this is a point of view that, let me sum it up with one of my favorite quotes from Pascal. He says, "Not all that is incomprehensible fails to exist." So we have to be open to new senses of being or new experiences of beings that are not initially comprehensible, but the challenges that challenge us to extend the range of our comprehension. And traumatic ontology is just a label for the attempt to understand a human experience in those terms.
All right, that brings us about to the end of the book. So as a final question, what are you working on right now?
That's a good question. Well, I have one small project writing about Heidegger and logic. He says in Being and Time that he wants a productive logic, such as he finds in Plato and Aristotle, which I take to be a way of generating new concepts. So I'm going to be exploring that for an anthology on Heidegger and logic. And I've been writing a lot over the years about memory, not directly in connection with Heidegger, but questions like what is memory? How is it possible? What are the different kinds of memory? What are healthier or unhealthier ways of remembering and forgetting, and trying to connect this to digital memory and how that's transforming our experience of memory. So that may or may not turn out to be a book, but it's something I've been writing about, at least for my own purposes.
Well, thank you so much. This has been really fascinating.
Thank you.